Hey, Victors, welcome to this week's Victory Show. If this is your first time joining us, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books, and I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, and entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling book as well. And in that journey, I've discovered a really fascinating pattern. A lot of businesses hit a revenue plateau, usually around $1 million a year, and then they struggle to break through it. So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they use to overcome those plateaus and scale their business to new heights so that you can do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting today. I'm excited for our conversation and our guest today. We have an incredible guest whose work is revolutionizing maternal health. Dr. Pinky Patel is not just a mom and a powerhouse entrepreneur. She's the visionary founder and CEO of MyRehealth, a groundbreaking health tech platform that's transforming maternal care through AI-driven personalized support. With a doctorate in clinical pharmacy from Oklahoma University and certification as a pre-postnatal corrective exercise specialist, Dr. Patel masterfully blends the clinical expertise with a fierce passion for bridging the gaps in maternal care. Her dedication to empowering mothers worldwide has built a thriving wellness community of over 50,000 followers, and her innovative approach has earned her recognition on the global stage, recently being named among the top 100 companies at the 2024 Entrepreneurship World Cup. Today, we're going to dive into her journey, her vision for maternal health, and the powerful mission that's driving MyRehealth. Dr. Pinky, thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited for our conversation today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. I'm excited.
I was fascinated by your background because you lived in like a foot in both worlds. You had a foot in the fitness, health and fitness world, and then you had a foot in the pharmaceutical world. And so that's such a, from my perspective, and when I get on Instagram and some of the influencers, you know, a lot of the people in the health and fitness are sort of anti-pharmaceutical, big pharma, right? There's that stigma. So I just find it interesting. You lived in both those worlds. I want to talk a little bit about how did that sort of shape your perspective in both of what it is to prevent and also then using science to help benefit.
Yeah. So the pharmacy aspect, you know, before I became a trainer, before Instagram and that little app existed, when I logged in Instagram, it was like a little, you know, the little square pictures. So that's when I started on the platform. But when I was in pharmacy school, the reason why I even chose pharmacy is because I loved the aspect of some chemicals, science, math. You know, I was really good at those things and I wanted to explore that more. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to pharma. I love medicine. In fact, I actually am the worst at taking medicine. And I actually would rather go the route of natural and holistic care, right? Of like taking care of my body, being a trainer, avoiding that. But I did like the aspect of pharmacy beyond just the pills, right? There were so many other aspects of pharmacy, ambulatory care, serving, impacting. But the foot in the fitness world actually came about because I was in pharmacy school. This is a random story, but I needed scholarship money. So I applied for a pageant and I didn't know that I was going to win because you win like $500 if you even participate in the pageant. Okay. I had three jobs in undergrad. I was even in choir and you know, did everything. I'm a small town Oklahoma girl and then went to another small college and I won the pageant and I was dead deer in headlights on. I was like, great, I'm going to Miss Oklahoma. And you know, I was like, I played sports in high school just because you do that in small towns, you do everything. But I wasn't like a hardcore into fitness. And so I was like, crap, they're gonna give me a trainer. I'm gonna have to wear this swimsuit.
You win and you're like, oh no, what did I get myself into?
What did I do?
And I was just like, wanted the $500.
My dad even gonna let me wear a swimsuit on stage. Luckily they're very forward. And so I was like, crap. So I got a trainer in school. And what I realized is as I was going through pharmacy school, they gave me the trainer. It was part of the program because I couldn't afford one at the time.
Wow.
And I was like, hey, this is really cool. Like lifting weights, I feel kind of good. And I really like this. And so that's how that intersection kind of, I was kind of forced into it. And then I just, as like when I graduated pharmacy school 6 years later, I actually on the week of graduating, I ended up getting my NASM certification to become a trainer.
Wow.
And so that was another passion of mine. I did bodybuilding for a few years before I had children. And so there was that foot in one because bodybuilding and fitness actually helped me build my character and my mindset and my grit and discipline around entrepreneurship. And I had no idea that that was going to be a parallel, but it just helped me. Like mentally, I loved being able to take up space. And I always said, no one can take my strength away from me. And so I just kept doing this whole fitness thing. But yeah, I get the whole thing like pharma on one side and trainer on the other. I feel like now, I didn't know this was going to happen, is that I've kind of combined it with Myri, with science, tech, real life experiences, you know, so it's like an intersection of all of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't feel like it's two separate worlds. I feel like it's kind of a blended world.
Sure. Well, that's what's beautiful. Like that's what I think is so amazing about that is because you've got both perspectives and it's allowed you to create, you know, kind of what you're doing now. So
yeah.
You're obviously a big advocate for maternal health. And so let's talk about where did that come from? What was your experience with that?
Yeah. So I didn't know that was going to be my passion until I got really pissed off in my own labor and delivery and reproductive journey. I did all my homework. I'm really good at that. And so typical valedictorian behavior, pharmacist behavior. And so it's like, I'm having a baby. Okay. I'm going to become a pre and postnatal corrective exercise specialist. Why? Because, well, it doesn't make any sense that these women are reorganizing organs. They're having this baby and they just walk out of the hospital and everyone's focused on the kid. And then she goes to her 6-week appointment to be magically cleared for everything. And then in the long term, everyone's laughing about peeing on themselves, joking about full pain with intercourse. It's just part of having a baby. So I was like, no, I'm going to challenge this. I'm going to go learn about this. So I did all of that. I had a doula. I had access to resources. I watched birthing as a business because I am very aware of the data around women's health. And I ended up finding myself advocating for my care in rooms during my own labor and delivery. So I had a 60-hour unmedicated labor and delivery. At hour 58, two men walk into the room. They whisper, let's just lie to her, give her a C-section, throw her in the OR. I get my feathers ruffled a little bit and I argue that and I ask for the data. My daughter was born perfectly fine. There was no need for a C-section. Often, yes, medically necessary. Was it necessary for me? No. And so that poised a question. And then the postpartum experience also got me passionate. Yeah.
But like, how fortunate was it for you that you had the science background and were, the phrase in my world is you geeked out a little bit about the science, but that data.
But I feel like that didn't help me. I feel like what really helped me to be able to formulate my own thoughts and empower, like advocate for my care. Cause in your gut, you're worried when you're in that state of vulnerability and you're growing a human, you're like, am I making the right decision? It was
When they came in and you asked for the data, you actually knew what data to look for.
She taught me when I engaged with her. She was like, hey, Pinky, like this is what's going to happen. You can learn you can be a doctor, you can be a pharmacist, you can do anything in science, but that doesn't mean you're prepared to know everything about childbirth, which is why you lean into your other resources. And I was like, I have 9 months to learn about everything so that I can bring this baby into this world the way I want to.
So did they just kind of stare at you with like deer in headlights of like, wait, this woman's asking us questions that nobody really asks?
No, and I live in Oklahoma, so we have tornadoes. So there's a tornado that weekend. And when there's tornadoes, nobody knows this unless you're in the Midwest, but the barometric pressure drops. And when the barometric pressure drops, a lot of women go into labor. So it was also the weekend. So it was just like a prime environment.
Like, this is the most fascinating thing ever. When the barometric pressure drops, it'll push women into labor.
And there's a full moon too. Like these are effects of if you believe in that. Yeah.
That was remarkable. What was your experience?
You have a phone appointment. Your hormones have exponentially changed. And the first appointment is for the baby, not you. So you might be crying. I was navigating breastfeeding, which was remarkably challenging for me, even though I did the classes. That doesn't help unless you physically have been in that process. Then the next appointment was actually at 6 weeks. And that's a long, long time when you've just had a baby and you're physically recovering and emotionally. And luckily for me, I didn't have the additional trauma of being thrown into a C-section, right? You're adding layers here. And that appointment is usually 11 minutes on average. 40% of women don't make it there. And they quickly do an inspection. Do you want birth control? Hey, everything looks good. You're back to exercising and doing every functional movement under the sun. And I challenge that. And I say, not every labor and delivery is the same. C-sections are major surgery. And there's a lot of things you can do to prevent long-term. Like, there are women living with back pain 20, 30 years later because of just not being appropriately recovered. So that was my experience.
Wow. Okay. So then how did you respond to that then? Is that the point where you started going, I need to start taking more charge of this for myself? And that's kind of where this started. You just kind of threw yourself into it to study it? Or like, how did that experience start to direct you?
I shared my experience live on social media. And that's when I was like, ooh, it's not just me. I'm not the crazy one. I'm not. Because you really, in that moment, you ask any woman postpartum, she is emotionally, like there's a lot of hormones that are changing. And you're like feeling like maybe there's some judgment. Maybe I don't want to share some of this information. But by sharing, I actually had strength and community. And that's when I was like, wait a minute. Every other mom is telling me they wish they knew. Oh, this happened to me. And I'm like, wait, a lot of this is preventable. Like if we just took a little bit of time, utilize science and access, we could prevent a lot of these things. And so that is what then led me to going, hey, this is a big problem. And I see the largest gap being in postpartum. We started as a postpartum care platform. Now we're maternal and postpartum care. But that is where I started. I had to start somewhere. Yeah.
Isn't it frustrating when you get into this and there's, 50% of the population is having some of these challenges and you realize that a lot of it is preventable with very sort of straightforward protocols.
Preventable with access and science and technology. We say 50%, still a large number, but when you also, the other way I frame it is that 50% is birthing 100% of the population. Mothers are the CEO, or partners are the CEO of the family as well in that stage. And so if they're not 100%, nobody is. So it's actually impacting everybody. It's just a silent killer by not supporting their women.
It's a good title for a book. Your partner is as the CEO. I am CEO, be the CEO of your family. So what did that look like? Was that, did you just jump right into the app space, or did you just start like consulting through the people you were connecting with in your community?
I wanted to be user obsessed, and I wanted to understand like what is a true pain point. I built a consultancy through my Instagram. At the time, it wasn't even what it is now. And I had a very loyal and authentic community, and it was a very successful experience. And I measure success as in, did I truly understand their pain points? What is something that we could actually quantify and improve? And what? How do I get this into the hands? And I always questioned this. And I was like, okay, well, when I was postpartum, I had a phone in one hand and a baby in the other. It was like, there's no ChatGPT. There's no voice. Like, there's no dictation. It was 2016. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to start with the app space. I'm going to pitch my CTO an idea. At the time, he was developed the app with his team. And I said, hey, I think we should, this is low risk. Didn't actually start that way. Actually started, nobody knows this. Many people don't. It actually started as a wearable. And then it was I developed a prenatal, a cream, a stretch mark cream with my own ingredients. And I never actually launched it because I thought this is too risky. What am I thinking over here doing tooling out of China for a wearable device? I have the prototype in my closet, never went live with it. And then I said, you know, let's do an app and we'll iterate it. And I'll just don't recommend this, but I'll launch it 3 weeks before delivering my son. And then we'll just see what happens. And I remember being in labor and people were downloading it. And I was fixing things on the back, like kind of adding more videos and adding more content on the ground while being in labor. Cause I was like, someone's using it. And I have to make sure that it works. Cause I'll be really busy in a little bit, which really busy as in like,
having you already had a full-time job and a daughter, and now you're having a kid.
Yeah, logged off. Actually, I worked until I went into labor. I just logged off and I took her somewhere for like one-on-one time and my water broke. And then I came home and I was just like, okay, I'm just going to stay home for a little bit while it's broken and fix this app and stuff. And so I just logged off my computer that day. It was a Friday.
That's such an entrepreneurial story. My water broke, but then I paused because I wanted to fix my app really quick.
Yeah, but then I had to save PTO for maternity leave because we live in America and we don't get a lot of time off. Yay. And so I did work until the very end, until 40 weeks.
So when you, all right, so the app launches, what happens with when the app comes out?
It's being downloaded and used, and I'm very stressed because I'm have this newborn and I'm not on maternity leave. So I have a bunch of pictures in the postpartum stage, which is just me and this computer and him nursing. And then what else? It's, add another twist to this. Couldn't get any better, but March of 2020 happens. I'm about to go back to work and a pandemic hits us and nobody goes back. My daughter doesn't go back to school. My son, we can't have our family help them because we don't want them to touch him because there's this random virus. So that's what happens. Women started using this on the App Store. Great way for me to garner more users and data. It was a subscription-based model. So we used that first year and a half to really increase our downloads and have women have some sort of tool to support them. It wasn't anticipated that COVID was going to happen. And it was a steady increase. It wasn't like some wild overnight success. Sure. Like COVID did that for a lot of businesses. But for me as a startup founder, it was a nightmare because I was going back to work and I did go back to work. So I did the full-time job during the day with everybody home and did build this at night.
And managed your family and the house all at the same time.
And nobody was allowed to come in or go out. Cause if you talk to any mother in that time frame, like, yeah, there's some folks that were baking sourdough bread and making TikToks. There was no sourdough bread. We were like wiping the bread that was even coming to our home. So we were in a state of flight or fight, and we had to protect our babies that we just brought into this world.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So, you know, that's stress levels on like three different fronts there. That's remarkable. So all right. So what part of this process then does Myri as a concept pop up? And when do you start realizing, wow, this is much bigger than just postpartum and that we need to incorporate the whole sort of maternal journey? Well,
yeah. I used to get on this thing called Clubhouse. Do you remember that app?
Yeah, of course.
And I taught myself how to pitch. So I'd change a diaper and my husband would scream at me from upstairs. It's your turn. It's your turn. So I'd throw myself into these rooms with these people. And then I realized, oh God, I need to learn this whole VC landscape. I need to go out and think about venture capital. How am I going to grow this thing? Because people were downloading it. And then I was like, you know, we have 44 paying countries and they're using it in English and people are paying for this. Like, what? And so I thought, there's a little bit more to this. And I knew that the earlier you get into the journey of maternal care, reproductive journey, the healthier the mother is. We want to be preventative, not reactive like the rest.
Sure.
Like it is now. Yeah. And so I started pitching, figuring these things out. And I thought, you know, I learned what an accelerator was. I taught myself VC language off of YouTube and books, safe notes, term sheets, all these things. And I was like, hey, I think we should maybe raise a little bit of capital, put a little bit of gas on this and see what happens. In that little time frame, it wasn't just like linear. It was very like, oh, and then we got into an accelerator and now we're being looked at by the benefit space. Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense because women have the shortest maternity leave here and maybe we could sell it to employers. So that whole journey, now we're B2B primarily, then led me to thinking, oh, I can reach more moms this way. And we're doing preventative work. And we got the data from some of the employers that we worked with. And we're like, oh, we're really improving outcomes and reducing claims costs. Well, this looks great if we could help and impact mothers that are insured by insurance companies, or just improve health equity by working with FQHCs, government funded opportunities. And then that just kind of, that happened last year. And then we're like, for prenatal care, yes, I wanted to do pregnancy from the beginning. Did I do it? No, because we didn't want to do everything at once. We wanted to really focus on one sector and then slowly expand.
Yeah. Well, you made the best decision possible. You created something that was just to get you out the door, and you jumped out of the plane and then you iterated. And I think that's the way the most successful companies are. You give them something, and then, you know, the market told you what else there was. But where does the term Myri come from? What is that?
So we were called the Snapback at the very beginning, and that was our first name, and I hate it now. But at the time I was like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. We'll snap you back. And it wasn't physical. We're everything against bounce back culture. Like, and at the time I was like, why do we think of this name? But it was like, you're going to snap back into your own mental space. Like that's what the intent was. Then it turned into Myri. Myri has some languages, it means mother. Like there's a suggestion that it means mother. Myri also could be my recovery, my pregnancy, like autonomy over their bodies and their journeys. And that my was very heavy on the my for me, because I was like, hey, this is my pregnancy. This is my labor and delivery. Get out of here. You know what I mean? So,
well, that's great though. It's because what you're doing then is you're essentially empowering mothers to have more, again, autonomy and authority over the whole process. Cause I think you're right. In American medical culture, for sure, there is the, like, it's very easy to like, oh, the doctor's the authority and I'm here and I just got to do what they say. And that, like, you're sort of, you know, flipping the script on that entirely, showing like, no, I know in my own personal medical journey, like with my doctor, when I started being a little bit more proactive and demanding like blood work and asking him why and taking more, my doctor actually became a much more willing participant in my health because he saw that I wasn't being reactive, I was trying to be proactive. And it's not something that a lot of people understand is even possible, really. And so what is the community with Myri today? Where is it? What's the benefits? Like who is, if somebody's listening and they're thinking they might want to check this out, like who's a good fit for this?
Yes. Anybody that has just gotten a positive on their pregnancy test, any mom that is postpartum, anywhere in that space, you know, even up to 18 months, we have always had an anonymous community. Obviously, Myri is an AI-powered maternal care and postpartum platform that provides personalized care for the mother using data analytics from end to end. Wow. The piece about community, that's just one little piece of Myri, and it's anonymous communities for mothers where they can talk among each other in any language and there's no judgment. And so what happens here is that the secret sauce is when you get mothers talking to one another, they learn about their own issues that they might be having, especially mental health, because we think we can, once we've given birth to a human, we think we can do anything. So if you tell us that we're like, maybe you're depressed. No, I don't have, there's high functioning anxiety, high functioning depression. I've had those. And so we're going to deny it. But when you talk to others, you're like, well, I saw this therapist, it felt good. Or I got on an SSRI. Hey, it's really helping. Or, hey, this is normal. Like, and then they start, when you curate those conversations, then we would find them going into the app looking for more evidence-based answers. Or, oh, you found this where you did a 5-minute science-backed breathing workout for 10 weeks and it actually helped you stop peeing. That's where the community talks. So these mothers can always have the community when they're pregnant or postpartum.
Well, and I think it helps too, right? To, like you said, before this, you feel like you're going through it all on your own. You don't feel like there's a support. Being in a community where women can go, this is actually a normal thing. I'm not the only one. Like, how reassuring is that? So at what point did the AI start and the data analytics start coming into the conversation? Was that something that you knew pretty early, or is over the last year you realized like, wow, this is really powerful? And let's talk about how have you used that in Myri, and how does that, like, how does that work on a user front?
Yeah. So the first question about the part about when we start, we were going to start adding AI. It wasn't like we were going to add AI from the beginning. You know, when we started this, it was all algorithmically driven. I mean, literally, I filmed 1,000 postpartum short clip videos while I was 6 weeks pregnant in a co-working space. And then we pieced them together in algorithms. There was no AI then like that. It was last year when we said, hey, we're going to go into the maternal care space, but we want to do it differently. You know, everybody was jumping ship at AI a couple of years ago, right? It's like, if you are not using AI, you're doing it wrong. With healthcare, you know, there's a big trust factor, right? So we wanted to do it the right way, but also know that we're working with a very vulnerable population. And with AI, we wanted to incorporate that very mindfully. And so it was last year that we had decided, and when I brought in my CTO full time, and he leads our technology, he's brilliant. And he also was very instrumental in starting to lay the brickwork and foundation around, why are you using AI? Like, just because everyone's, you know, we didn't want to just jump ship. And then the most important piece is, how are we leveraging AI? So I think it's really important to then go into the next piece where you're saying, how are we revolutionizing this whole thing with AI and science, right? You know, I've been asked, like, how are you identifying risks early in pregnancy and improving care? And it's because we're proactively identifying the complications before they escalate. So our technology is leveraging real-time data, clinical guidelines, and predictive analytics to flag concerns like gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, or mental health challenges. How? We're connecting to wearables. We can connect to various apps and devices, holistically understanding the mother through lifestyle history, family history. And if we can get integrated with our EHR, which a lot of health systems are letting us do, that means we get retrospective data and seamless data. So we also don't stop at identifying the risk. We tailor that intervention, whether it's evidence-based education, connecting them to a specialist, or prompting a healthcare provider to step in. Then we're helping the mom to have a healthier pregnancy and reducing the costs long-term.
Well, this is fascinating. You're using tech to create a holistic approach from start to finish, which is just fascinating to me. So you're blending the best of both worlds. So as an entrepreneur, because I mean, you started out as a doctor in pharmacy, what have been some of the challenges for you launching your own business? I mean, how long did you hold on to the day job before you realized you just couldn't do it anymore?
It was the most challenging thing I'd done. My parents came here with $7 as an immigrant from India. So the American dream was needing to be fulfilled by me.
No pressure.
So you had to become a dentist, doctor, lawyer, whatever, right? And so I did the thing. But after I did the thing for 13 years, you know, I was sitting in this room and I had at the time just a $35 Walmart table because we moved into the new house the week of COVID. There's no furniture. So I remember there was a Walmart table here with my equipment for my pharmacy job. And then Myri lived on the ground. And so I would bring a balloon in here, play with, like, have my baby go around with a little fence in the room, and I would work on it, you know, and on my off hours. One day I looked at the table with the $35 table with the computer and with the security of health insurance and my six-figure salary to the ground, which was where I was going for a while because I didn't pay myself. And it was very difficult because I was carrying the health insurance for the family and a lot of security in a very uncertain environment called the pandemic. And it was challenging, but every night I was validated by other women, like, hey, I'm using this platform, it's working. And then it took a lot. I did a lot of work on myself before I even launched this thing. And I think nobody really knows about this, but I spent, for somebody who is very attached to routine, structure, and has anxiety around leaving something for entrepreneurship, I never thought I'd be one. I had to work on myself. So I had invested in time in podcasts, listening, not being on them. I had invested time in, like, mentors, growing my brain in terms of saying, hey, accepting failure, which was very, very difficult, of like, this isn't a possibility. But I had to remind myself that you can always get your other job back. Like, if I don't take a shot at this, I couldn't sleep at night, like, for many years, not because my kid was waking up, not like that at all, up that too, probably. But it was one of those things where I was like, I had to give it a shot. And that was the most challenging part. Everything else is still equally challenging. I have more reds than I have greens in terms of, like, rejections, whether it's from VCs early on or, you know, everything that I've tried. And I always remind myself, since I'm a numbers girl, that it's a numbers game. Mentally, I've reframed it. I've said every no is a next opportunity. And the more shots I take, the more I'm going to get rejected. So That was challenging early on to be able.
Yeah, that's a big thing. How long after you made that decision did you wait before you told your parents?
I told them. They've always been very supportive, and they know that I'm very driven, and that if I want something, I'm going to figure it out. If anybody believes in me, it's them as well. And so it wasn't like I was hiding it. It was just more of like, they're like, okay, that's cool. And so, but then I tried to explain to them, you know, explaining something to a generation where they're like, even anybody, actually, a startup that's constantly changing, you're like, well, what are you doing? Well, today we're doing this. And I think we're going to do this now. You don't really tell people exactly what you're doing because it's kind of changing. It was like, she's playing on her computer. She's always on her computer. She's doing something with technology on her computer. But that wasn't the fear. They kind of knew that was going to happen because I was doing too much for a long time. And it was like a lot for me. Yeah.
I've had conversations. So I've been in my business for over a decade. And you know, a couple of years ago, like everyone else, I had 6 months where revenue wise wasn't super great. And I still remember having conversations with one of my parents. I won't say which one. And they were like, how's it going? And I'm like, look, business is brutal right now. Here's what's going on. And I still remember them going, aren't you sure you wouldn't want to just go get a nice job and get the steady paycheck and whatever? And I'm like, that's their generation. Like, that's the security. And I'm like, even though I had been in business for 8 years, to them, the like, no, working for a company, that's the where the security was, right? And so to your point, right, sometimes it's kind of hard to explain, what is it that you do? So how have you had to grow as a leader in running this company?
Every way. I feel like you're constantly having to figure out what type of leadership style you have. I think a lot of what I experienced in leadership from corporate America taught me about a lot of things I didn't want to do. So that was a great starting point. Like, I remember certain things and feelings that you can't take away anymore. And so I thought, well, this is something I don't want to do. Let's start here. And then I did a deep analysis, and I spent a significant amount of time watching and reading about other leaders and their styles and what worked and what didn't work and what I wanted to embody myself. And so I can't say I just started built a company one day and decided I'm going to be that type of leader. It was like, no, I knew exactly what I didn't want to do because I remember feeling like not valued at times, micromanaged, you know, and so these are the type of things I never wanted my team to feel. And on the flip side, how I learned different leadership styles, and I'm still learning. I think there's a part of this where nobody talks about where you're always having to grow as a leader because you're challenged at maybe it's the 500,000 mark or the 1,000,000 mark or whatever, you know, when we get there. But every situation brings on a different challenge. And they're like, well, how do I want to approach this? And so I think one of the things is I knew what kind of culture I wanted to build, and I knew what kind of foundation I wanted. And that is something that one can take away from you. And then you build brick by brick around that, I think. And also looking at other leadership styles that I didn't want, right? You turn the TV on long enough and you can find enough people you don't want to be like. I don't watch the news for a reason. There's enough going on. But I think the one thing that I do know is as a parent, majority of this workforce are parents in an early stage as well. They've in some shape or form. And we don't treat them like humans sometimes because their productivity is 100% dependent on their ability to be flexible at times. If things, you know, like in this particular country, parenting is challenging because you're coming back at a different stage in your journey. And I think I do deeply believe in accountability with flexibility. And so that is something that I know we have new parents that are and are admiring. And that's something that I can say that is kind of my leadership style. Those things no one can teach you. You can study as much as you can, but until you're in that seat and you're looking at a team and you're going, okay, how are we doing this? That's
the interesting thing with being an entrepreneur and being a leader, right? There is the myth of like, oh, when I get to X, then things will be easier or better, but you never arrive. You get it to the top of one mountain and you realize like, oh, I'm just at the bottom of a bigger mountain. So if somebody's listening to this and they want to be involved with Myrie and what you're doing, how do they find it? How do they get involved in the community?
Yeah, they can certainly reach out. There's MyrieHealth.com, MYRIHealth.com. They can reach out to us on social media, LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on social media myself. Dr. Pinky Patel, you can find me there as well. But yeah, there's many ways to get involved. If you know anybody who's pregnant or postpartum, we're available on the Apple and Google Play Store for download. And you know, I talk about how we support mothers through B2B channels, but we're actually still available on the App Store, and a lot of women utilize us out of their own pocket.
Wow, that's fantastic. All right, I like to end every conversation with three questions, and these are personal questions. So we'll wrap it up with these. If you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
One piece of advice, to not rush into things. I was on such a timeline in my 20s and teen, like late teens, that I felt like even taking 1 year off or going abroad or deviating from the course was going to put me behind in life. And I thought, now that I'm almost turning 40 next year, I can't get that time back. Mm-hmm. And so I wish I would have spent more time and not rushed myself to get to the certain goal, because I was always trying to go to the end goal. And I see myself doing this with Myri right now too, in some aspects. So I'm still learning, but it's like, when I get here, oh, I'm going to get to this goal. Being like, it's the journey, it's not the destination. And I know we see that cheesy quote everywhere, and I'm just like, yeah, I've seen it before. But really, now I look back retrospectively with two children, like, I really wish I would have taken some more time and given myself more grace, because I never did that.
I had a good friend that grew up in England, and I was living in LA. She was in her 20s. She was always traveling. She would work really hard for 6 months, and she would disappear for 3 months, and she'd just go travel the world. And I remember asking her one time, like, I don't, what are you doing? And she's like, Americans have it backwards. She's like, all you guys are like, you put all of your time and your energy and your effort in your 20s and your 30s to like work really hard and make a lot of money. And you're like, when I retire, then I will go. And she's all, but it's backwards, because right now you have the energy to do everything. So travel as much as you can now, because when you get to be 70, you won't care if you're sitting at a desk working, because you'll be like, I'm just glad I'm sitting down. And I was like, I have never heard that before.
You might not even be like going up, being able to go up the stairs in Italy, because by the time you're there, you might even have a cane. Yeah. Like, you know, and so there, we always talk about when we retire, and you're like, wait, who knows what your health is going to be like then?
Sure. So a minute ago, you talked about one of the investments you made in yourself was getting mentors and getting your mind straight. So is there a belief or a mindset shift that's had the biggest impact on your success or your happiness?
Belief or mindset shift has to be okay with failure. That is something they don't teach you early on. I'm doing a very intentional job of teaching my children that, because failure is part of it. I was never taught that. Every time I had failure early on, I was really hard on myself. And that time that I spent marinating in that failure, if you will, could have been time spent figuring out the pivot. And so I always say the velocity at which you pivot determines your success. And
that's a great statement.
I really feel like startups have to do that, or else you're not going to survive. And so I think learning failure early on and navigating that is key to success, because you are going to fail. Like, if you take 100 shots versus 50 shots, you're going to have more chances of failure.
I saw on X maybe 2 days ago, I saw a huge marketer has an 8-figure company. And he said the comment, he said, if you knew you were only 30 failures away from having your ideal life, how quickly would you fail? And I'd never heard that before. I was like, I'm only 30 failures away, and I'll get there. So
that's a great way to reframe it. It's like, because you could quit, right? You could quit now. And it's like, well, you're just like 40 almost quits away to your next win. And so it's about like reframing it as just like, get 40 more failures, you know, like, it's kind of a good thing.
Final question. What's the best investment you've ever made in yourself?
The best investment in myself has to be the selfishness of my time in the morning before my family gets up. So whether it's 30 minutes of 5 minutes of journaling, chugging a pre-workout, and 25 minutes of strength training to spend time with myself before the world gets me is my best actual like non-financial investment. Best financial investment is therapy. I think that every entrepreneur or anybody that is in any relationship should be seen by a therapist. We should have quarterly check-ins with somebody that can help us navigate feelings, because entrepreneurship in itself will test you in more ways than one.
Sure. I was at a fireside chat in Santa Monica years ago, and the guy who was the founder of QuickBooks, Intuit, he was worth $8 billion. And somebody asked him at the night, like, what's the biggest mistake you've ever made in your business? Without hesitation, he said, biggest mistake I made in business is I waited too long to get a business coach. I didn't get a business coach until just a few years ago. And he said, had I started that in my 20s, he's like, I would probably be worth $70 billion today instead of only seven. To your point, I think when you have the right mentor and right coach, the therapy is kind of an aspect of that, where they help you navigate all those things. Dr. Pinky, thank you so much for your time. This has been an amazing conversation. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.